We'll be moving public hearing on Senate Bill 957 toward the end of the meeting today. And we will open the public hearing on Senate Bill 606. Senator Nelson, would you come up, please, with your...
Mr. Chair, great bill.
Great bill, yes.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is David Nelson. I'm a state senator from Senate District 29 out in Eastern Oregon. And I'm here along with Sheriff John Trumbull from Unitowan County and friend Anna Peterson from the Meth Force Task Force or something like that.
That's right.
So they can introduce themselves and come along. But I brought this bill at the request of Sheriff Trumbull just because he's right on the ground and he's finding out that a lot of the things that he's doing as far as arresting people and trying to solve the meth problem in our part of the country, which is a very, very big problem, we're just not getting the job done. He needs some more tools. And so he brought this bill, and the good chair asked me if I could check on the constitutionality of some of the issues, and we did that, and so we have some amendments here. But it's one of those situations where what we're trying to do is we're trying to solve a problem that I think that much of the community is concerned about. You've got some handouts up there. There's a newspaper article, and then there's a poll, and then you also have Sheriff Trumbull's testimony, written testimony. But the poll was kind of interesting. It's an informal poll that our local paper does all the time, and it shows that 56% of the people support Sheriff Trumbull's bill in its original state. Now, we've changed it because there were some constitutional issues there. But you can see that our community is very concerned about this, and I think this is one of those situations where you have somebody on the ground trying to do the job that we're supposed to be doing, trying to solve this meth problem, and has come up with a proposed solution. There's going to be probably some opposition to this because they're saying, well, maybe we can't do this or cannot do this, but that's why Anna's here. And she can give her viewpoint from the meth task force, and Sheriff Trumbull can give his viewpoint. And with that, I will just end and ask them to testify.
Okay. Welcome. Welcome, Sheriff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm John Trumbull. I'm the sheriff of Umatilla County. I've been with the sheriff's office for 30 years. My law enforcement career is 34 years. In the last 10 years, I've been sheriff. I'm one of the original members on the governor's meth task force, and I'm also on the executive committee of the governor's meth task force. The time has come for the state of Oregon to stop supporting the drug use and abuse occurring by some citizens who are on the state-supported public assistance. There is a segment of our society that needs financial support to meet their basic needs of food, clothing, and shelter. There is also a segment within that group that is abusing the process by buying drugs with the money provided to them to meet their basic needs. I'm here today to discuss the citizens who are abusing the process. Rather than go through my written testimony, I think maybe what I need to do is just tell it like it is. Unfortunately, Umatilla County has had the dubious distinction of being number one in the nation per capita for meth lab seizures 1 year, and we've been right at the top one or two for the last 3 or 4 years on meth lab seizures. So I know what drug use and abuse is doing. I did a poll of my jail, and I asked them to kind of keep an unofficial count of how many people that come into jail are on public assistance. And the number was pretty high. Chief Walt Myers, who used to be the police chief of Salem before he retired, Chief Myers and I was talking one day, and he said he thought about 80% of the people that his officers arrested were on public assistance. That got me to thinking that we really need to do something. My goal with this bill, members of the committee, is not to punish people. I think that prevention and treatment are the two salvations we have in the fight against drugs. We have to get these people off the merry-go-round. This cycle of addiction is not only hurting them, it's hurting their children, it's hurting society. We have to hold them accountable. Courts can order drug treatment, and parole and probation officers can make sure that they do it. but there's still a lot of them that aren't successfully completing it that are on public assistance. There's an awful lot of people that are on public assistance that don't get involved with the criminal justice system. So they're falling through the cracks. My goal with this bill is to provide treatment to these people so that they become good, productive citizens, and while at the same time continue on with their public assistance. I don't think it's going to serve any useful purpose to cut off the need that they need just because. I think that we have to hold them accountable for their actions. They have to know that if they're going to continue to use drugs, that down the line there's going to be some consequences for their action. I've included in my presentation, and that you have, it's an article out of the LA Times. And the first paragraph says, the most comprehensive assessment of California's landmark effort to bring drug users rather than jail them has found that nearly half the offenders sentenced under the program fail to complete rehab, and a quarter more never show up for treatment. That's 75% of the people that are sentenced to drug treatment through the courts that are failing. The high failure rate has prompted a growing number of critics to call for jail sanctions for defendants they say take advantage of the program because it lacks penalties. And that is my whole premise. We have to have a consequence. There has to be something at the other end that if they don't successfully complete treatment, they're going to lose their assistance. Also have in here, it's a public forum from Douglas County. And I received a lot of emails when it became public that I had asked Senator Nelson to introduce this legislation. The one that I received that I thought hit the nail probably more squarely on the head than any of them was from a gentleman named Leonard Wilson from Riddle, Oregon. I have a question not only for Douglas County but for the entire state of Oregon. I have a job. I work. They pay me. I pay my taxes, and the government distributes my taxes as they see fit. In order for me to get that paycheck, I'm required to pass a random urine test, which I have no problem with. What I do have a problem with is the distribution of my taxes to people who don't have to pass a urine test. Excuse me. Shouldn't one have to pass a urine test to get a welfare check? Because I have to pass one to go earn it for them. And I think that sums it up to me pretty clearly. We're requiring employers to randomly drug test their employees so that they're good, safe workers. And I think that if we have a segment of society out there that needs our help, that's fine. I just don't want to see the welfare program go from being a hand up to a handout. Thank you.
Questions? Senator Bridger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sheriff Trumbo, if you had a 90-day residential program in your county and were able to have access to treatment for people that you pick up that had to go there, were court-mandated there, and any public assistance that they got followed them into that program, you probably would feel differently about that expenditure of public funds, don't you think?
Senator, I really don't know, because money is going to be a huge issue on this, and I'm not under any illusions this is going to be cheap, because treatment costs are going to be expensive, and testing costs are going to be expensive. There's going to be training costs that are going to be expensive. But I think what we need to do is look at the overall cost of this. Can you take the cost of the treatment and the testing and that and put it in one side, and then how much is it costing us to continue to allow these people to continue their drug habits? And if it only affected the person, that would be fine, but it's not. It's affecting their children, and drug-endangered children are becoming a huge issue nowadays. We have a lady in our drug treatment program locally that is in a drug court right now. She's going to have a baby. This will be her fourth. It'll be the first baby that she has that hasn't been drug affected. Mm-hmm. So that proves that treatment works, and that proves that drug courts work, and that proves that we have to provide some motivation to these people to get them into these treatment programs, and then at the same time support them, because I don't expect them to be destitute, and I don't expect their children to suffer because their parents are drug abusers. Mm-hmm. But I think that just keep throwing money to them is... They're using that money to buy their drugs. We're just compounding the problem.
Right. Follow-up, Mr. Chair. Yes, the reason that I framed the first question was that my dream is to see every county with a 90-day treatment program. And sometimes that means that some assistance, in other words, if that individual goes into treatment and they qualify for food stamps, that management of that treatment center is able to take that those food stamps and use it. That's the way that they help fund the treatment program. And so the thing that's wrong with the way it is as you very eloquently stated, and that is that there are people that are supporting other people's drug habits, which is not exactly what people intend for their taxes to do.
I did a local survey, Senator, just off the cusp. Talk to people, and I do a lot of traveling around, and I've talked to a lot of people, and I've had 100% support from the average layperson on the street for this, as long as we continue with their support. Nobody wants to see little children go without food and clothes. They don't want to see their parents go without food and clothes, but they think we need to hold them accountable. And the bill in its original form gave them three strikes before they're out, and I don't know what you can do to encourage a person any more than that. We start our drug treatment programs in Umatilla County in our jail. They start in the jail, they transition into community corrections, and then we have a treatment available for them when they get out. And so I know the treatment works. Our recidivism rate's one of the lowest in the state. But we're fortunate because we have a really good community corrections program. And since it's a division of the sheriff's office, I have the ability to direct how a lot of that is done. And the jail and community corrections is intertwined. And they start in our jail and they just keep moving on through. So our success rate's pretty good. But that's not always the case in other places. So.
We're talking random drug tests, right?
I think that if a person is applying for public assistance for the first time, it should be mandatory. And if they flunk the test, then they sign up for a treatment program, and their public assistance will start, and that will start the countdown.
Do you have enough space and money for treatment? For the number of people that, what if the number of people exceed the space and resources, what happens to them?
I would not be a bit surprised, Mr. Chairman, that's going to happen. Because mm-hmm. I think that if this is done properly, you're going to see there's a very, very high percentage of people on public assistance that need treatment.
Okay. So are they then going to lose public assistance if there's not room for them to be treated?
No. No. They have to. When they get to the point where they lose public assistance, it's because they've lost it, not because we have taken it away.
Okay.
Because we weren't able to provide them what was required.
Okay. How's your county budget these days?
Terrible. Probably a lot like the state.
Well, okay, and I guess one of the concerns that I have in general with treatment programs at the county level, where most of them take place, is the state resources are lacking and being cut, as well as the support to the counties from the timber receipts. Now, I don't know if your county advises timber receipts. I think if it does for roads... You know, people might be taking money from treatment programs to put into the road program. I mean, that's, you know, there are counties that, there are only a few O&C counties in the western part
actually,
of the state.
Actually, a lot of our treatment programs are self-sustaining because people in our jail that are going through the treatment program, that treatment money is provided by the inmates in their commissary and phone system.
Okay.
We turn that money right around and send it right back to them in treatment programs. Community corrections, of course, is supported by the Department of Corrections budget, mm-hmm. and part of that budget is for treatment. So that has its own funding source there.
Okay. Do you have any idea how many people you're talking about?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have a clue.
Okay. because that's...
But I would guess, just from what we're seeing on a local level, that it's probably fairly significant.
Okay, and so what you're saying is that when people apply for public assistance, they take a mandatory drug test.
And if they flunk it, they need to start in a treatment program.
Okay. Other questions? Yes.
Mr. Chair, I guess that's what I was trying to say in the beginning, is that if they lose the public assistance and then you need to put them into treatment, they're not people that have been arrested and put into jail, which is where your treatment starts. So what we need is access to treatment in counties where you're able then to take the public assistance away, but then you have a place that they can go through treatment. And if they've been receiving public assistance and they've been buying drugs, there could be a way of some public assistance following that program, except that it helps pay for the treatment of the individual. And I thought about this a long time and a lot, thinking in terms of statewide counties and how we were able to do that. But I think if we take public assistance away and they need treatment and you don't give them treatment, of course, they can go steal, and then you'll put them in your jail, and then they can get treatment. But I don't think that's exactly what we want.
No, and like I said, my intent with this bill is to just hold people accountable. And they have to flunk 3 drug tests before they get kicked off public assistance. I mean, at what point does the light go on and people start realizing that, you know, we need to turn our lives around?
Right.
Okay, so... what you're saying then is when a person signs up for public assistance, they would have a mandatory test. If they fail the mandatory test, they would still get the public assistance.
As long as they were in a qualified, certified by the state treatment program, and they did everything.
Okay.
And that's the reason, Mr. Chairman, that I included this article on Prop 36, is because there was no penalty at the other end, and they were just shaking their head and going the other way.
Okay, I'll go back to my first question. What happens if you don't have access, if you don't have room in treatment for the number of people who flunked the first test? Are they cut off then? Because you don't have room in treatment, so are you going to put them on assistance and then hope that... One of the scenarios I thought you might be talking about is that they flunk the first test, then they're on public assistance, and there will be other tests. And if they flunk the other tests, they're off. But if there are... I don't know how much room you have in treatment for the number of people that might...
And I have to be honest with you, Mr. Chairman, I don't know how much treatment is available.
Yeah.
I would guess that treatment would have to get some pretty significant dollars to ramp up for what might occur.
Yeah, well, okay.
And if they're in treatment, they would go through random drug testing to make sure that they're that they're not failing.
Listen,
and that's what happens
that.
In all treatment now anyway.
I understand that. Yeah. Senator Cruz,
thank you, Mr. Chair. I like this bill a lot. It's a lot softer than my version, but because I had a very similar bill. And I do think it's appropriate, and and you're right, Sheriff, that the fact is that if there aren't consequences, people are just going to game the system. They have been forever. And treatment is totally ineffective unless there are consequences behind it, because it's an easy game to play if you're an addict, to go into treatment and come out and not have learned a thing and just put in your time, and then you get out of jail free card. And that's basically the current system. I would suggest, Mr. Chair, that capacity is definitely an issue, but I would assume that they would still be considered eligible if they were on a wait list. So at this point, there's probably no other way to get around that. Is if there's a slot, you go. If not, you're on a wait list, and the next available slot is yours. That's probably the only way something like that would work.
My intent with this bill is to get the discussion started.
Okay.
Obviously, the lawmakers of the state are going to have to fine-tune it and get it to a place where everybody can live with it. But But there has, somebody has to take the first step, and that's the reason that I asked Senator Nelson to work with me on this, is because we need to start the discussion.
Yep. You're right.
Mr. Chairman, just to follow up, if we had some change in federal law, we could do this right. But that is a barrier we have to deal with.
Okay. Would you like to...
Thank you, Chair Morissetti and committee. My name is Anna Peterson, and I chair the Governor's Meth Task Force. I am a volunteer. I live in this community. The Governor's Meth Task Force has not taken a position on this bill, on Senate Bill 606, this session. We did, however, discuss this same similar issue in the period in 03-04. And we had great discussions both at that time concerning the misuse of the Oregon Trail Card and the, excuse me, appropriation of trail cards, trading for drugs, and et cetera. We also had concern about the need for treatment services and the need for incentives for people who are drug addicted to be seeking treatment and staying in treatment. I speak also from my experience in this local community as the co-founder of No Meth, Not in My Neighborhood 4 years ago. Still continue with that task force and that effort. And I have the opportunity to talk with people from throughout the community, citizens like myself, who are concerned about misuse of public money and public funds. And their concerns are that if people are drug affected and people are receiving assistance from the government for food and are not using that to buy food and to care for their children and instead are converting that so that they have money for drugs, that's a concern to citizens like myself. The public will to support government programs certainly increases when they feel like money is being well managed and well spent. So I speak from that perspective as well, that incentives are important and management is of their monies is important. I couldn't agree more strongly with regards to the needs for treatment. The Governor's Meth Task Force firmly believes in prevention, enforcement, and treatment. It must be in a three-legged stool with equal legs. This session, the Governor's Meth Task Force is really in support of and speaking out for treatment services. They are sadly lacking. I have a chance to visit around the state. I've seen in other communities, not just this one. I see the families that are affected by drugs, and I talk with people who are waiting to get off of drugs, who are waiting for treatment services. So I like to also say that that certainly is a very, very huge and underlying need, and it must be addressed in this state in order to have the quality of life for people, both those who are involved in the criminal justice system, but many others who are not, who are struggling with drug addictions. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yeah, Senator Virgin.
Mr. Chair, we have a treatment center in Oregon that I think could be duplicated. It's Stepping Stones. Have you visited
Stepping Stones?
Mm-mm. Well, Stepping Stones is a 90-day treatment program in, I believe it's Klamath Falls.
Mm.
And it is for people that don't go to the fancy places at $10,000 a month. With insurance and 30-day treatment facilities that don't work. People with insurance spend an awful lot of money and get out, and it hasn't been long enough. Stepping Stones is a very good treatment, has a great thing, and I would encourage you to take a look at that program, because I believe that, you know, if we were all queens and kings for a day, we might just decide that that's what we'd do in every county in Oregon.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Before you go, I guess my concern is the fact that we don't have enough treatment spots available in your area. The funding isn't there, both at the state level and the county level. The problem that you describe is a real problem and needs to be addressed. I'm concerned about the backup that could occur. Well, first of all, the mandatory testing to start with, I don't know if every employer requires mandatory testing. There is a probable cause aspect, or random testing is more normal. What I'm wondering is if there couldn't be a pilot project that could be effectively created that would allow something to happen on a smaller scale that has some certainty. And, you know, look at it that way, because I think to pass a bill like this on a large scale, I think it could be chaotic and not necessarily accomplish anything. But
Mr. Chairman, I have to be honest with you. Anything that we do is going to be more than is being done now. Mm-hmm. Whether it's a pilot program, passage of this bill, anything that we do to address this issue, which is becoming huge, is going to be a step in the right direction.
Probable cause would be one way of doing it. Now, I'm on the subcommittee of the Ways and Means Subcommittee of Health, and we also have heard some very inspiring success stories of a woman who broke the generational addiction in her family by not having her daughter raised in an addictive atmosphere. Now, you mentioned that, and she was very proud of herself because her family, her father and mother, were drug addicts, and she grew up in that atmosphere. She became one. She has three or four kids, and her last child is raised in an addiction-free home. And the drug court made that happen. The drug courts are extremely important. Now, I don't know what kind of treatment drug courts require people to take. I think there are a variety of programs out there. But I think it's... I guess I'd be interested in taking a look at how to move on this in a reasonable way, you know, that we could manage financially.
There is a lot of great programs out there, and there's a lot of people that really care deeply about getting these people off the merry-go-round.
Yeah.
I think the key element is there has to be something at the other end to motivate people to successfully complete it. If you don't have something, you're going to end up like California did.
Other questions,
comments? Mr. Chair, just to follow up, we aren't talking about a random testing program. We're talking about an entry-level testing program, which a lot of, I would say at this point, more businesses than not do screen on people applying for a job on the first go around. We do that in my business. We aren't big enough or necessarily have the resources to do random testing and treatment and things like that. So from that perspective, I think this is doable on the front end, and it's just a screen. It's not a denial of services, but I think this would do two things. It would be very, very beneficial. Number one, it would give us the opportunity to find out the scope of the problem, and for those who maybe there are not slots for and would be on a wait list, it would put them on notice that we know they have a problem, and some might be self-correcting from that perspective. So,
okay. Well, that was one of the questions I raised. If a person is tested, mandatory testing at the front end, and a slot is not available, are they denied services, or are they put on the waiting list? So, okay. Thank you. We will continue our testimony. Vic Todd, Andrea Meyer.
Members of the committee. My name is Vic Todd, Administrator for the Self-Sufficiency Programs within the Children's, Adults, and Families Division of the Department of Human Services. And I'm here today to testify in opposition to Senate Bill 606. While I agree a lot with the comments that have been made, I want to go through some of the issues that we see and describe some of what we currently do in program areas. This bill would affect the cash assistance within public assistance. Currently within the cash assistance programs, clients who are identified as having a possible drug or alcohol addiction are referred for drug and alcohol screening. And if they are assessed to have an issue, they are referred for assessment by a provider and or treatment.
Excuse me. Clients who are, how do you determine if a client is to be referred?
Chair Morissette, as part of the assessment process of the temporary assistance for needy families, okay. TANF families, the adult, mm-hmm. The case manager will, and working with them and during and doing the upfront assessment, will make an assessment of that, or in many cases the client will volunteer it.
Now, does that ever include a test, a drug test?
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, if the client is referred to a provider and the provider determines that that would be appropriate, then the provider could require it. We don't generally do that, okay. Make that as a requirement, but when we refer someone, that does occur. It's not a mandatory piece, but it does occur as part of their process.
Okay.
Within the governor's budget, there is several areas where the governor is expanding efforts around the drug and alcohol arena of treatment and so forth and assessment. Within the proposal related to the TANF reauthorization, we have expanded the assessment and evaluation process generally for clients, and that would include expanding mental health and alcohol and drug assessment processes. So those expansions are within the governor's budget at this moment. Senate Bill 606 would have significant financial impact in that we estimate that we would begin to test about 640 new clients every month, and on an annual basis for redeterminations, about 11,000 clients would need to be tested. And so that with an average cost for each test of about $42. Within the testimony I've given you, we have estimated the cost for just that testing piece, and that would amount to about $2 million general fund. Those funds are not within the governor's recommended budget. We have not attempted to estimate what additional treatment costs might be. Also make a comment there related to any potential reduction that would result in the TANF caseload would likely be offset by shifts of children into the child welfare arena as a result of the families becoming more destabilized. The last point that I wanted to speak to was that the state of Michigan also had passed a law related to having drug testing as an eligibility condition, and that statute was overturned. Several other states were looking at passing legislation along this line and found that using other methodologies enabled them to identify clients who needed treatment. So with that, I'll end my comments and take any questions if I can.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
How did they identify the clients? I'm not sure I follow that.
Chair Morissette, Senator Moniz Anderson, these other states that I mentioned in here, New York, Maryland, Louisiana, et cetera, used survey tools and other just assessment tools to do that process rather than have it be a mandatory drug test.
And follow-up, they found it reliable?
Yes. That's what my understanding is.
Okay. Thank you.
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, legislative director for the ACLU of Oregon, here to testify today in opposition to Senate Bill 606. I want to address at the outset sometimes a misunderstanding that many folks have about, well, if the private sector can do it, mm-hmm. why can't the government when it comes to urine analysis and other and drug testing and other things? And the reason is because when the government does it, it's invoking a search under either the Fourth Amendment or the Oregon Constitutional Provision, Article 1, Section 9, the equivalent. And as such, there are certain safeguards before our government can do it for generally whatever purpose it is doing it for. So while the ACLU would go on record saying we don't support the private sector doing it, we are not in a place where we can challenge it legally. We have a number of concerns with this proposal. It appears to us to really be discriminatory in targeting welfare recipients with no scientific evidence that they are any more or higher users of drugs than the general population. And it codifies a perceived difference between the welfare community and the general population, which we believe is not only an incorrect assumption, but is patently discriminatory. And, you know, there's lots of state and federal assisted programs that come from our tax dollars that go to a lot of people. And this is just picking out one. You've already heard some concerns about the cost. The cost of actually implementing the test would be extremely costly. I think there was testimony suggesting that the individuals, the recipients of the benefits must or could pay. I would suggest that's probably impermissible to condition a benefit on a payment. So I would suggest that that legally actually would not be sound, let alone a bad policy decision as far as we're concerned, to require those who are in the most vulnerable positions to pay for a drug test when there is not even a reasonable suspicion. But we'll get to that in a moment. There's also, you've already heard, treatment costs. It's significant. And you're conditioning public assistance on someone maintaining treatment, and if the treatment's not there, they seem to be out of luck. There's also 14th Amendment due process requirements. If you revoke someone's public assistance, there is due process requirements for a hearing to be held before benefits are revoked. The effect will be on children as well, because, as you all know, there are families involved, and when you deny benefits to one, you may be affecting the children. Now, I briefly want to touch on Senator Morissette raising earlier, unclear to me, but the term probable cause, it gets often thrown around. Well, if there's probable cause, well, we need to be careful when we use the term probable cause. That's a judicial term, a term of art that our judicial branch knows and applies, and frequently our law enforcement does, because that is where you get a court order. You've provided sufficient evidence to establish that there's evidence of crime, and you need a court order. And this is not people who are suspected of criminal activity. This is a blanket. So I just really don't want us to confuse sort of the criminal world and the judges creating court orders after proper consideration of probable cause versus this area.
Okay, thank you. I was thinking when you started that you can't have a blanket test. The public sector has to be careful. I know that at one point there was concern that the state police, they wanted the police to set up roadblocks and stop every single driver along the way to test them to see if they were drinking. And that was a lot of people applauded that and thought that's great, that's the way to go. But that runs into the same kind of concern, I think, that you raised about testing everybody. However, probable cause in the loose meaning of the term, if an officer sees someone that looks like they're drunk, they can stop them and do the test. And that is, okay, maybe probable cause is not the right word, but if they see someone who's swerving...
Right, Chair Morissette, that's reasonable suspicion with a particularized suspicion that they're engaged in criminal conduct. So that's a very different scenario. And law enforcement officers are trained, extensively trained, not only to observe someone's behavior to suggest that there's criminal activity, but also what establishes reasonable suspicion and then probable cause. But I kind of want to get to the punchline, and I know Senator
minute.
Cruz came back just in time
okay,
to hear
hold
me.
Hold on, Andrea. Mr. Todd said earlier, and Senator Montes Anderson questioned him about the assessment and whether or not it's accurate. Now, during an assessment, that may be similar to a police officer determining if someone is on something. An assessment without a drug test may be a perfectly valid way to go.
Chair Moore said, I'm not sure they condition a benefit on an applicant filling that out and seeking assistance and suggesting that they might want treatment opportunities in these other states. I think it's a tool to help to where then Department of Human Services and other departments can help recommend and advise for those who want to, but they're not conditioning a benefit or a revocation of a benefit on complying with that. I do want to have an opportunity to focus on the what is sort of the punchline here, I believe,
okay,
for us.
She was waiting for you to come back.
I appreciate the timing
you
was
knew that you would be the beneficiary of this.
ACLU would go on record as saying that we believe this provision, Senate Bill 606 with the dash 2 or without, is unconstitutional. And it's unconstitutional under both the Oregon and the federal constitutions. It's both a warrantless and suspicionless search. And the courts, and I'm talking about our federal courts and our Oregon courts, and not the ACLU, but our courts, have established extremely rare limited exceptions to when this can happen, when the government can do it. And I know, Senator Cruz, you missed the opportunity when I know you've talked about the private sector doing this, but when the government does it, it's a search. It must be more than a general desire to have a drug-free situation. The exceptions require very specific, well-documented, and clearly articulated public safety and public security situations. So I want to give you the two examples that they've said it's permissible. In Skinner, the government drug testing of rail employees involved in train accidents because they said the duties were fraught with risk of injury to others and the close nexus and tie there to the accidents issues and the evidentiary issues around that. The other one is National Treasury Employees versus Von Raab, and that was drug testing of, Treasury employees who were directly involved in drug interdiction and carried firearms. And both the court said those raise extraordinary safety and national security hazards, and so both those circumstances. But the most recent U.S. Supreme Court decision, which you all may applaud or not, in Chandler, an 8-1 decision, was the attempt of Georgia to require candidates for state offices to undergo drug tests. Again, we have an interest in a drug-free workplace. We have an interest in our elected officials who are passing laws to not be under the influence. Court rejected it soundly, 8-1, that was insufficient. The ACLU of Oregon prevailed in a case against Woodburn where they attempted to require a pre-employment drug testing of a Woodburn librarian page. The court again held it violated both the Oregon and the federal constitution. And as my cohort here testified momentarily about State versus Michigan attempted to do this. Actually, it was a less restrictive one. It was just random drug testing. And Marchwinski versus Howard, the trial court, in no uncertain terms in 2000, and this decision was upheld in the Sixth Circuit, said it violates the Constitution, analyzed all the case law I've talked to you about, and said no. Now, in addition to we are really strongly believe that we violate the Constitution, when I talked to the lawyer handling our Oregon case, he's eager to jump to the gun. I told him to not to jump the gun, but he's ready to challenge it. And we do believe it would be really patently unconstitutional. And I think the other risk the state does is it's susceptible to attorney's fees in this type of action under the Fourth Amendment violation if a party prevails in this. I think that really covers my point. I mean, I know that there was some discussion about, well, I'll skip that. I just will leave it at that. We'll be happy to answer any questions, which urge you not to go forward with this. We think the case law, even the United States Supreme case law, is really crystal clear in this situation, and this would not pass in any way.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Senator Morris Anderson.
I think that Sheriff Trumbo has a perspective. Most they, I forget what percentage, 80%, 90% of those who are incarcerated are involved in drug trafficking, whether they're using or not. And so that perspective, I mean, usually the criminal behavior is due to the fact that they need meth, and that takes money, and therefore they're committing crimes. I'm not sure if I'm right on that perspective, but it's a huge percentage. So at least from that perspective, he is right on. When I take a look at the WIC, the Women, Infant, and Children program, I would say the majority of them are not on. They're on public assistance, but they are not using. I spent most of my public health career working with at-risk moms. A number of them were. I mean, I did work with drug-addicted moms and drug-affected babies. But I was just wondering what ACLU would think of at least focusing on those that are incarcerated. Would you still say it would absolutely be against the Constitution and not require drug testing?
Chair Morrissette, Senator Montesanson, I want to clarify one point you made. You referenced about an 80% people incarcerated for drug trafficking. I don't know
drug
if
use
drug use,
or
most likely
whatever.
Personal use and personal addiction rather than drug trafficking. Conditions of release can be, and part of parole and probation can be drug testing. When you are convicted of a crime and you do lose some of your rights if you're out on probation or parole, which is the opportunity to be out, but you're still under the purview of the court and there are restrictions, the government can go in and search your house randomly. It can provide drug testing. It can revoke your term to be back
incarcerated. You're not answering my question. What I want to know is what if we focused on those that were incarcerated and mandating drug tests on those that were incarcerated?
Chair Morrissette, Senator Montesanson, I'm trying to answer. If you have probable cause that the person you've arrested is under controlled substances such that you do a drug that is permissible through a court order, because no, if you're just looking at the incarcerated population, saying let's drug test the incarcerated population, I'm not sure that's permissible. Just doing it randomly or doing everyone, there's a huge cost. But for what purpose? I mean, if the purpose is to provide the opportunities for treatment, which we wholly support the need for, and I think there's a lot of people who are incarcerated that they already know they don't need the drug testing to know that they need treatment. But if you're then talking about narrowing it to people who are then or who have been on public benefits, I think you have huge problems. You'd still run afoul of the Constitution. You'd be targeting, picking out one population impermissibly.
No. I was trying to get out of those that were on public assistance, but maybe focusing on a population in which we were truly that we know that the huge percentage of them, the reason that they are incarcerated is because of drug use, drug trafficking, drug.
Okay. Chair Morrissette, Senator Montesanson, if your purpose is then to deny them the benefits of public assistance,
no, just to have the testing.
Well, you have to do it. It can't be suspicionless or without a warrant. So you need to start back at that threshold, and if you were just to pick out the population that's incarcerated on public assistance, you'd have huge problems. I think constitutionally to just targeting without reasonable suspicion. And
okay, I want to leave that part of the discussion and go back to what you said is currently happening. Now, if a person goes through this analysis without drug testing, and then they are referred to whoever. Who are they referred to? They're referred to a clinic.
Chair Morrissette, yes, that's correct. To an A&D provider, an alcohol and drug provider who would do that assessment.
Okay. Now. It seems that you're getting at the heart of the matter there. When you do the intake, now, is this true in Pendleton? This is true in Pendleton as well, right? People who are going on to public assistance, they sit down with someone from the state who does an analysis on their condition. I mean, their financial and other things, right?
Chair Morrissette, that's correct.
Okay, it's an analysis. Then they refer them Okay, they're applying for public assistance, and is the decision made that they need alcohol drug treatment as part of that assessment?
Chair Morris said it might be.
It might
or,
be.
Or it might be that they that the case manager thinks that may be an issue, okay, and they would refer that person to that professional to make an assessment.
Okay.
And then if that professional made an assessment and said, yes, this person should be in treatment, it then start. It would move towards becoming part of their plan within the TANF, you know, jobs program.
Okay. Now, that would involve drug testing at that point. Is that correct?
Chairman said potentially it would. It does not always.
So that is a way of arriving at the testing that is legal, constitutional. People are applying for public assistance. They go through an analysis and interview. If there is evidence or at least a suggestion that there is some problem, that there is a problem, then that person is referred to a treatment program, can be referred to a treatment program. Drug testing can take place at that point.
Chair Morissette, I don't know that we could mandate the client to take it.
The drug test. Okay.
I'd have to get back to you, but I don't think we.
Well, I'm trying to think of the circumstance that may be happening already. That is happening already. That meets that need. That is legitimate, or at least it meets all the constitutional tests. And. So I understand what you're saying, Andrea. I understand that part. There are some legal limits to requiring someone to do something unless there is some compelling reason to do that, and it has to be a compelling reason, right?
A very high standard, Chair Morissette, that the courts have said. I mean, I think you've hit the nail on the head. I think the caseworker and the dialogue is the most, one, it's the most productive. It's a relationship that's hopefully being developed, that there's some trust and ability to share information about what's really going on in their lives and to really seek the type of assistance they need, which may just be more than the public assistance but other resources, yeah, and then how to get to them and what opportunities are available. You know, that's where hopefully with treatment that's wanted. And I don't know the statistics. I know people, there's numbers out there about how many times folks go through treatment before they actually, you know, kick an addiction. And it's not, I believe, the first time through, but.
Depends on their consequences.
Yeah, Senator Bridger.
Yes, thank you. Andrea, let me just respond a little bit to you, and then I'd like to respond to Mr. Todd as well. I like to think that public policy is made on common sense and a sense of fairness and not trying to go at people with against their constitutional rights. I don't think that, certainly that's not my intent when I try to settle on good public policy. I do like to see it settled here and out of court. I don't think that's the best place. And about a hearing, I think you're absolutely right, and I think that would be appropriate. And on your comment about children, and that is that children are suffering before. In other words, they're suffering under your scenario or under the sheriff's scenario, so I think children are just going to suffer. But to Mr. Todd, I think the thing that the sheriff is objecting to and probably has large public support is that in the cash assistance program, it is going to people who are using the funds out of compliance to buy drugs. In other words, when you give people cash assistance, it is not with your good housekeeping blessing that they go and spend that money on drugs. Isn't that correct?
Chair Morissette, Senator Berger, that is correct. I think that we don't want to reverse the causality, though, in terms of the drug issue. Comes to our door, and so what we're trying to work towards is family stability, and part of that is trying to assess that family's scenario and get those people into treatment as necessary, and knowing that it does oftentimes take multiple iterations of that, but it is I think it's important to remember that it is not the majority of the population that this is an issue with. This particular bill is really addressing the cash assistance portion of public assistance, and there are other bills out there that take a broader look at this in terms of covering, you know, all of public assistance. And so I would say the same thing about that, that there is a percentage of the population that have these issues, and there is a large percentage that is not an issue.
I agree. Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I have a question to ask you about that. You receive federal funds. Is there something that in your agreement with the federal government that says that you have to use a process whereby if you give a person cash assistance for their light bill or their heating bill, that you must pay it to that person and not to the company such as PPL?
Chair Morissette, Senator Berger, there are situations where we do pay the vendors in terms of managing the client's resources.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
You know what's coming, don't you?
Yes.
You know what's coming.
Well, no, but maybe.
Yes. Yes, your overpayment. Your millions that you need now to collect, because people have spent the money in a way that they were not intended. So I think that the objection, there may be a way to get to this. I think that just randomly, many, many people receive public assistance who do not have drug problems, who are living a very good life, and do have a constitutional right. On the other hand, I believe that there is public support for not handing out cash assistance to people who are using that money to buy drugs. So how you get to that, I don't know. And smarter people should do it. But I do would like, since I have you at the table, I would like to recommend very strongly that you pay vendors and that you lack the kind of overpayment situation that you find yourself in.
Chair
Morissette, Senator Berger, I think that the overpayment issue is not related to this from the standpoint of the overpayments tend to be related to errors that have made in terms of either, you know, client error or agency error in making the determinations. I think that one of the critical comments that was made is that this really is a three-legged stool, and that we are trying to provide services for clients that are affected by drug addiction. And I think there is a role for each of the components.
Okay. Chair Morissette, Senator Virgil, can I just say I appreciate your comments about the role, and as much as
the hammer's coming down,
as much as you may be frustrated by what I say, I'd rather bring our concerns here and have them addressed than in litigation in court any day.
Okay. Can I just briefly? I don't want responses. I just want to make a statement.
Okay.
Two statements, actually. Number one is the fact that probably the most successful drug treatment we have in the state is drug courts, and the reason they're successful is there are consequences. And without consequences, drug treatment will be highly less successful than it is with consequences. And the other point, Mr. Chair, as far as the constitutionality of it, this would not be the first time the Supreme Court misinterpreted the U.S. Constitution.
This court misinterpret the Constitution?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Close the public hearing. I just want to thank the sheriff for being here. And I understand. I empathize, and I think, you know, that's something that we really have to work on. So
well,
thank you very much.
Indulgence and listening to me. So.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, we closed the public hearing. We already did that on 606, and we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 47. Bryn Sable, would you give a summary of this, please? We're paying you big bucks for doing that, and I forget to ask you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The committee heard Senate Bill 407 on February 28th. Requires all managed care plans, health insurance policies, and insurance providers provide patient freedom of choice from among all health care physicians. Allows health plans to require and really select a primary care physician. Requires insurance companies to cover clinically necessary health care services provided by chiropractic physicians. The committee does have before them the Dash 1 amendments and a hand-engrossed version of the bill. The Dashwood Amendments removes references to foot, dental, and vision care. It replaces the requirement that insurance companies offer patient freedom of choice from all health care physicians with the requirement that they allow patients to choose from at least 50% of chiropractors in each geographic area.
Okay. Yes. I'm sorry. I did call your name.
Okay.
I apologize for not.
Is that a Fleetwood Mac CD? No. Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Vern Sable, representing the Chiropractic Association of Oregon. You have in front of you the Dash 1 amendments. First, I'd like to say that it's come to my attention. If you on the first page, line 5, subsection 1, casualty insurance has the meaning given the term that term in ORS 731.158. Apparently, unbeknownst to us, that would apply to workers' comp. That was not the intent of this bill, and we would be willing to. Work on additional amendments that would take care of that problem so that, in fact, this does not apply to workers' compensation, which was not our intent. Again, the rationale, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the rationale for the Dash 1 amendments do two basic things. One, it eliminates the other service providers, health care providers, and only provides for insurance coverage for chiropractic services. The other change is from an open-ended any willing provider provision to a provision mandating a minimum of 50% of the chiropractic physicians in any geographic service area. And we're using the workers' comp geographic service areas that the managed care organizations allow up to 50% of the chiropractic physicians in that geographic area, as opposed to an open any willing provider provision. If there's any questions, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, relative to what I've just indicated, she's having.
Okay, yes, I'll have. How do you.
It's on a disk and on a flash drive.
How do you envision the insurers trying to figure out which chiropractors? I guess it's sort of like anything else. They have a contract, and they just contract with certain chiropractors. I assume that's what would happen. So each chiropractor, I'm a little bit confused as to how that would work, because
would your chiropractic board do that? They've got it all together.
No, because the insurers set up the contracts with the employer, and so then the employer would need a panel of chiropractors would have to be chosen, so therefore people would have to really look at their contracts to see which chiropractor they could go to.
Well, that's what we're attempting, Mr. Chair, Senator Munson. The rationale for the bill is to increase the panels, which, in our opinion, we respectfully submit, are extremely closed and restrictive. There's two panels I know of. There's some approximately 800 chiropractic physicians in the Portland metro area, and these two panels have 50-some colleagues, which simply does not provide Oregon consumers a true choice, especially if, in fact, they are currently seeing a chiropractic physician that they've seen for years and their employer changes insurances, and now they've been told they have to go to select from one of these panel docs, and they've built up a relationship of trust over the years with a particular chiropractic physician. Now they can't go to that chiropractic physician. By having a minimum of 50% of the chiropractic physicians in a geographic service area, at least it opens up choice and has a more probable likelihood of capturing that chiropractic physician that employee has been treating with for years. how we envision it working is simply chiropractic physicians in that geographic service area that would like to be on panel simply submit an application and go through standard credentialing. And if, in fact, they make it through credentialing, then they are placed on panel. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, another issue that came up last hearing was a comment, I think it was one of the Kaiser physicians, questioning whether chiropractic physicians qualified as primary care providers.
Now, Vern, how long is this going to take?
A couple hours is all.
Oh, well, as long as we're out of here by 9 tonight, I think we're okay. No,
seriously. I'm going to try to do it. Ilana said I had to do it in 5 minutes.
Okay,
so
very good, because we've got a lot of people.
Chiropractic physicians indeed do qualify as primary care providers. This is the new definition of primary care physician by the Institutes of Medicine, published in 1996. Primary care is the Committee of American Health and New Era Committee on the Future of Primary Care, Division of Health Care Services, Institutes of Medicine, published in National Academy of Press in 1996. Definition of primary care from the Institutes of Medicine is the provision or integrated accessible health care services by clinicians who are accountable for addressing a large majority of the personal health care needs, developing a sustained partnership with the patients, and practicing in the context of family and community. It goes on to state the definition of clinician means an individual who uses a recognized scientific knowledge base and has the authority to direct the delivery of personal health services to patients. The Council on Chiropractic Education specifically states the purpose of chiropractic professional education is to provide the student with a core of knowledge in the basic and clinical sciences and related health subjects sufficient to perform the professional obligations of a doctor of chiropractic. Council goes on to state, a doctor of chiropractic is a primary care physician whose purpose as a practitioner of the healing arts is to help meet the health needs of the individual patients and the public, giving particular attention to structural and neurological aspects of the body. As a gatekeeper for direct access to the health delivery system, the doctor of chiropractic's responsibility as a primary care physician include wellness promotion, health assessment, diagnosis, and chiropractic management of the patient's health care needs. When indicated, the doctor of chiropractic consults with and co-manages or refers to other health care providers. It's been shown in two studies that chiropractic physicians can, in fact, manage 90% of the 60 most common conditions presenting to a primary care office. And what are those 60 most common conditions? These are the 60 most common. I won't belabor the point with the 60 matching most common diagnoses. General medical exam, cough, routine perinatal exam, symptoms referable to the throat, postoperative visit, well baby exam, earache or ear infection, back symptoms, skin rash, stomach pain, cramps, spasm.
Sure. I have never heard of a chiropractor that did prenatal exams. That's standard care for chiropractor?
Well, it's in those who choose to provide primary care. We are licensed in obstetrics, gynecology, minor surgery, and proctology as well. Fever, visual dysfunctions, hypertension or high blood pressure, knee symptoms, blood pressure tests, headache, pain in the head, head cold, upper respiratory infection, nasal congestion, chest pain, and related symptoms. Number 20, these are in frequency of presentations as well. 21, depression. Physical exam for employment, other symptoms referable to the ears, not elsewhere classified. Leg symptoms, allergy medications, skin lesions, low back symptoms, foot and toe symptoms. No complaint. Diabetes mellitus.
No complaint.
Vertigo, dizziness, shoulder symptoms, hand, finger symptoms, acne or pimples, anxiety, and nervousness. So, I won't believe it, the rest of them. Part and parcel to this list is I wanted to point out the core curriculum at Western States Chiropractic College, the Doctor of Chiropractic, part and parcel to being able to act as a primary care provider. Some of the courses that are, and these aren't all the courses, of course, but that are pertinent to this, nutrition, physical diagnosis, general pathology as well as clinical pathology, which is to study diseases primarily by laboratory means, blood chemistries, tissue samples, microbiology and public health, toxicology and pharmacology, dermatology, clinical lab, chlorative and differential diagnosis, neuromusculoskeletal diagnosis, gastroenterology diagnosis, cardiorespiratory diagnosis, genitourinary survey, obstetrics, bone pathology, this is relative to x-ray diagnosis and ruling in, ruling out, frank pathology or bad stuff on the x-ray. Soft tissue, radiographic interpretation, minor surgery, proctology, clinical pediatrics, and geriatrics. Was that 5 minutes? So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we do and respectfully submit that we do qualify as primary care providers. So, again, the basic rationale for the amendments were to apply this only to chiropractic services and the 50% of providers in a geographic service area, and we're using the workers' comp, current workers' comp geographic service areas as the map. That completes my testimony. I'd be willing to answer any questions.
But you mentioned that the amendment mistakenly implies this would be a worker. What's wrong with this as it's written?
Well, and maybe that's where the problem comes in. We're using the workers' comp geographic service areas. This bill is not intended to apply to workers' compensation, however.
Okay. So you said it would need a further amendment then?
Correct. So it's ensured that this, it's clear that this is not does not apply to workers' compensation. That
don't,
was not
don't
our
intent. Don't you want it to apply to workers' compensation?
No. Well, I would, of course, but that's, we've come to a...
That's a different...
That's next.
Well, we just got some movement for the first time in 17 years from the Management Labor Advisory Committee, and we have agreed to that, so...
Oh, okay. Okay, other questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
The list. Okay. So we'll start at the bottom and move up. Mike Dewey. Mike, are you here?
No.
Mike Dewey is not here. Lisa Tressel. Lisa's here. Ed Hybrost, Ed, not here.
Ed,
John
Ed
Powell
Neger?
Is not here either, right?
Ed
no, he isn't. Oh, there he is. John, would you like to take that empty chair, please? Okay, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lisa Tressel with Associated Oregon Industries, and here wanting to express concerns over Senate Bill 407. And I appreciate that Dr. Sabo is addressing one of the issues, but we had two concerns. One was we weren't sure how it would impact the cost of health insurance and workers' comp, and he's agreed to take care of the workers' comp element, but we would still have concerns over what the impact of contracting with 50% of a particular provider in the context of health insurance with preferred provider arrangements, the impacts that would have on rates, and also just practically speaking, and the carriers, since they're the ones that negotiate it, probably have it very clear in their minds how it might work, but how do you assure that you're going to get 50% of the providers in any given category to agree to the terms and conditions of a PPO arrangement? So,
now, Lisa, did you say who you represent when you introduced?
Associated Oregon Industries.
Oh, okay. I thought you did,
have.
But I may have missed.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ed Niebert. I'm the Director of Regulatory Affairs for Providence Health Plan. We're a nonprofit health plan covering approximately 125,000 Oregonians with insured plans. My first question upon reading Senate Bill 407 and the amended engrossed version is, if this is about a mandate of some sort for inclusion of chiropractic care, it seems to me that Section 5 of the bill is the heart of the bill and perhaps ought to be the entirety of the bill, because the preceding sections create a number of, I think, troubling and in some cases not fully sensible side issues. For instance, the inclusion of a managed care entity as including a health care facility, a preferred provider organization, or a third-party administrator. Those entities do not provide insurance coverage. If you're worried about insurance coverage, let's focus on insurers. And in fact, those entities are not subject to regulation directly for the purposes of providing chiropractic care, a health care facility, a preferred provider organization. If there are worries about chiropractic care outside of insurance arrangements, for instance, self-funded, self-insured arrangements, which cover a lot of Oregonians, unfortunately, as you may have heard in other contexts, the state cannot regulate self-funded benefit plans. Those are the exclusive jurisdiction of the federal government under ERISA. So I would say I'm very troubled by some of the meanderings that occur before we get to Section 5. But to comment on Section 5, which is the heart of a chiropractic mandate, I think Providence Health Plan is fairly typical among insurers. We provide a rider or endorsement or an option, if you will, to include chiropractic care in your health benefit plan. It's electable by the group, the employer, that buys the coverage. About 30% of our groups choose the chiropractic coverage. And those that don't choose it make their choice, we assume, on some mix of judgments about added cost to the benefit plan. We all know that every dollar added to the cost of a benefit plan is another straw on the camel's back of healthcare costs. And we include a network of chiropractors in our optional coverage that is about 25% of the chiropractors that are licensed. We use that network because we think it helps us focus on high quality, cost-effective care, yet with a broad choice. So a chiropractic mandate for us comes down to, do we wish to take the 70% of our clients who voluntarily choose not to add chiropractic and say, gee, I'm sorry, you must have it, and here's the incremental cost? Or do we leave it as an option which seems to be functioning pretty well in the marketplace? Thank you.
Thank you, Ed.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Mr. Chairman, I actually made a chart for you, but you made it outdated today. I listed all of the mandates that I could find, about 30 of them, and their current status. Of the 30, 8 are out of committee or have passed one house or the other. 2 have work sessions scheduled now. Two of them have work sessions scheduled, and 2 of those mandates we already cover. So we're getting close to half of them being on their way in one way or the other. Of all of those, this is probably, however, the one with the most potential cost impact on the health care and health insurance. And we oppose the bill unalterably. And I don't know, the 50% contract language is troubling. I don't know, every year you would increase the number, and I don't know how you keep track of that, but be that as it may, I think it does very little to benefit the bill. It still would allow those chiropractors to be primary care physicians. At your initial hearing on this bill, we provided testimony on what we think makes that problematic. And then, finally, it exempts policies written on public bodies. And I think that's an acknowledgement of the costs that are affiliated with this bill. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we would hope that you would not move this bill forward today or any day until the legislature adjourns. Thank you.
So what you're saying is the medically necessary clause is not going to work this time.
Mr. Chairman, maybe that's true.
Think about that, John.
I understand, and that's a good one.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Mike Dewey missed his chance. Jane Allen, would you come up, please?
Chair Morissette and members of the committee, Jane Ellen Wydance with the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. Thank you for allowing me to testify before you today. I'm testifying on Senate Bill 407, not necessarily in opposition or in support of the bill, but in confusion regarding the bill. In the first page of the bill, under Section 1, sub 6, I think, in the hand-engrossed version of the bill, it talks about a managed care entity means any person including but not limited to a health insurer providing health insurance, a health care facility as defined in ORS 442. And the reason I'm confused about this is I don't understand how a health care facility could be mandated to do what this bill does, and a health care facility is defined in this piece of the statute actually includes hospitals, nursing facilities, and other health care facilities in the broadest definition of Oregon statutes. So we're just not sure how this works and what's the intent, and are very confused about that process and what it means for our members of our organization.
Do you find yourself confused a lot?
Chair Morissette and Senator Cruz, I want to say no, and I'm going to say no. I'm really actually confused and actually usually enjoy this. But this bill, I just don't see how it all hangs together. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I couldn't resist that. So
I'll get you back. Oh.
Okay. I know you will.
So with that, we will close the public hearing, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 957, and James Tate, would you come up, please?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Welcome.
Did you want to get up here?
No. James.
Mr. Chairman, and members, I was sort of planning to go after the proponents of the bill, but let me just clarify a little bit.
We're going to get right down to the nitty gritty.
We're going to get right to the nitty gritty.
To see if we really, really need a bill.
Well, let me explain very briefly by way of background. Several weeks ago, we testified on another bill here that has to do with planning for the future of long-term care, and we distributed some data to you all that really, really lays out the demographic issues that face not only Oregon but the entire country. Oregon's 65-plus population will double within the next 20 years. We expect the numbers of seniors and people with disabilities that we serve in long-term care, that caseload will double. So there's many implications both in how we're going to pay for expanded services, where we're going to draw the workforce from, and, of course, that same population, the fastest-growing cohort or subpart of that growing population are the 85-plus group. So increasingly, we're going to have a more medically fragile population that will need long-term care services. Again, we've been involved for the past 3 years in a long-range planning effort looking at how we get communities ready and how we begin to retool our long-term care system. One of the groups we've been focusing on is whether or not we should explore and expand models that would actually integrate long-term care and acute care services. And the reason that the overall logic for looking at those kind of models is, as you look at the 85 plus population and you look at an increasingly medically fragile population, many times it will be the acute care side that actually triggers either the need for long-term care or changes in long-term care. So the whole issue that we're interested in looking at is how we can bundle care together in such a way that you pay attention to both sides, you carefully coordinate care. We have one model in Oregon. It's Providence Elder Place, known as the PACE program. The federal designation is a program for all-inclusive elderly care. It actually bundles Medicaid and Medicare. And much of our interest in this is actually based on the experience of the PACE model in Portland, run by Providence Health Systems. They serve about 700 seniors, persons 55 and over is the age cutoff. We've looked at a lot of their data over the years. The folks they serve, that cohort of 700 folks, actually has almost identical acuity levels of care as the rest of the people served in long-term care that aren't part of an integrated acute care long-term care system. And the outcomes are pretty remarkable because it is integrated. They have much, much lower rates of hospitalization. Out of that 700 group that they serve, for example, at any given time, about 1% of their population is in nursing homes. When you look at our overall long-term care system, it's about 15 or 16%. And again, hospitalizations, ER visits, most of their participants or residents end up either dying in their living setting or at home, not in hospital. So it's pretty compelling data. They have physician ratios of about 1 to 80. They do very intensive screening. And when you go and look at and visit with the people and you talk to their families, the consumer satisfaction is incredibly high. So that's really piqued our interest in looking at other types of integrated models where you could actually put both the acute care and the long-term care side together and do overall care coordination that would make sense for the population. There are obvious concerns by stakeholders, and you'll hear some of those today, concerns about giving that much control over a person's life to a single entity or organization. I think that's certainly a concern. I won't try to attempt to speak for the other stakeholders. The other issues that have been raised are concerns that perhaps this is sort of the leading edge of the wedge for us to privatize the whole system. That is not our intent. What we were looking at is one or more pilots that would be like the Providence Elder Program, but within the bundled Medicaid part of the system. At this point in time, to do any other models outside of the PACE model, which is a federal designation, it's part of a state-approved state plan option under Medicaid, we would have to get new federal waivers. And so there's certainly nothing in the works right now, no secret planning going on to develop these models across Oregon, but continuing to plan and research what they would look like. For those who are concerned that we might have a hidden desire of some sort to privatize the entire system, ORS Chapter 410, which is one of the best statutes in the country, actually defines the role of local government as having first choice in terms of operating much of the Medicaid program. So we would not even have the legal authority to do a whole scale change in the organizational structure of long-term care, even if we wanted to, and we don't want to. So I want to lay aside some of the fears that have been articulated with this. My comments to our stakeholders during our planning groups is we have no immediate plans to launch other models, nothing in the foreseeable future. We have, again, no federal waiver authority to do that. I know there's been talk about potential amendments and concerns about whether we would attempt to do something further without legislative approval. We certainly always seek legislative approval, and if we change programs or fund them differently, we always include that in our recommendations and proposals to be vetted by this body. So those would be my comments.
On the record. right?
Mr. Chairman, always on the record.
No, the reason I ask that is because, you know, I'm trying to figure out if we need a bill. Now, we're going to hear from the proponents of the bill and as to whether or not we need the bill. You, even if you wanted to, you couldn't do anything this biennium, right? Or could you?
Mr. Chairman, I don't believe, based on the research we've done to date, that we have the legal authority to do models of integrated care outside of the PACE model. We would need new federal waiver authority, and certainly to do anything on a broad scale, we would not have the statutory authority, as I read it.
Okay. Now, you are working, you do have a work group on this with the proponents of the bill, trying to come to...
Mr. Chairman, we've had several work groups on this whole idea. The first one was just sort of what populations could potentially be served in an integrated care model. We then set up a second work group to look at just what the consumer protections would be, because that was one of the first concerns. If you, again, give that much power or control potentially over a person's life, what are the consumer protections that would need to be built in? And Dr. Kitchen, our medical director, has been working with a group, and they've completed several drafts. People are still looking at those drafts. But I guess, Mr. Chairman, in response to your question, certainly we don't think legislation is needed. We think this is a process that is clearly out there in the open. We're working with all of our stakeholders, and we certainly don't anticipate or plan making whole-scale changes to Oregon's long-term care system.
Thank you, and we may have you come back up, but I'm trying to get to the bottom line of this. And Jim Davis, could you come up, please? And then we'll decide where we go from here.
Senator Morissette and members of the committee, I'm Jim Davis, representing the Oregon State Council for Retired Citizens, okay. United Seniors of Oregon, and Save Oregon Seniors.
Jim.
Yes.
I want to apologize in some ways for not having you come up first, because this is your bill.
Oh, no problem.
But I did want to see, you know, right up front what the intent of the agency was, whether they are planning to move ahead. If this is something that needs more work and so on, but I do definitely want to hear from you, so go ahead.
Thank you, sir, very much. We come in very strong support for Senate Bill 957 because it really takes a very simple stance with regard to what we consider an extremely serious issue of developing and merging acute care and managed health care plans into our model community-based long-term care system. And it really did it did start to brew in with efforts by SPD to develop a pilot project, and that's what ultimately enhanced our concern to much higher levels. And then we decided that it made sense to develop legislation, since there is such universal opposition to this concept within our communities, that it made sense to develop legislation that said if they were to develop, if SPD and DHS were to develop new policies or new projects that would lead to the incorporation of managed health care into Oregon's model system, that they would first have to come before the Legislative Assembly in some way. And so the way it is currently written, it came out of Legislative Council incorrect, and I think, Mr. Chair, you're aware of this, and hopefully other members of the committee are. We have submitted quite some weeks ago amendments that would clarify that, and that would present language that's closer to what we had originally submitted, which was to say that we wanted to prohibit the Department of Human Services and SPD from moving forward with any proposals, programs, or pilot projects to integrate acute and long-term care services in the direction and involvement of fully capitated health plans with the SPD system without approval from the Legislative Assembly. That was the exact language terms of what we submitted to legislative council originally, and it didn't quite come back that way. Not as if, you know, all of us would disagree with the way it came back, but that was not our intent. Let me just give you a little bit of background, if I might, in terms of why we are so opposed to this. Oregon, as you well know, has built one of the national models for in-home and community-based care that really tries to provide the most independent living environment for seniors and people with disabilities. It is a system that has been developed on a network of services that go across the board to help people live in their own homes or have community-based options such as assisted living or residential care facilities or adult foster homes. It is a government-based program that is a national model, an international model, and there's serious concerns about any attempt to try to integrate into this system, manage health care. Our concerns, as I said, began to grow when we began to see that there was a pilot project that was being developed by SPD around the development of managed health care within the long-term care system. And it was being done through the State Work Group on the Future of Long-Term Care. But as we looked at it, we began to see that it was something that was rolling down the tracks and did not have, in our estimation, adequate involvement from the grassroots advocates who would have been strongly opposed to this kind of concept. The vast majority of the work group on the future of long-term care, which a who's who of senior and disability advocates, were adamantly opposed to this concept or the development of this project. And it was at this point, when SPD continued to work on this project, that we decided to implement this legislation. The one glaring problem with proceeding to test such a privatization program such as this is to look at the universal opposition amongst clients and advocates and providers and area agencies on aging and long-term care facilities. And when you look at the fact that literally everyone in our system is afraid of such a concept, and I'd like to be able to tell you, I want to describe, and I'll do it for fairly quickly, why we have these fears. But it was really unusual in our estimation that this would be pushed so strongly by SPD, and it was of great concern to us, especially with the strong stance against it. But with this strong stance by SPD, you would think that there were some real strong benefits for seniors and people with disabilities with this approach. And we've been unable to isolate any kind of measurable benefits, and we see a lot of damaging results that could come of this. There's no positive evidence that the inclusion of managed health care in the community long-term care will positively impact seniors and people with disabilities, and both in terms of services or costs. There are two major ways that you can cap senior and disability services. One approach that was recommended and thankfully failed in the last session was to cap the number of SPD clients who would receive services in the community. That's one way you can do it. The other approach is to capitate the flow of money into the system, and that the involvement of managed health care, one of our principal concerns, is you have a capitated system where a certain amount of money would be flowing into seniors and people with disabilities, and as our population grows, and the boomer population is going to double our senior population, that ultimately services could be limited, and there could be limitations on the number of clients that would be served. It could potentially create long waiting lists and change the long-term care system as we know it. And so there's two major areas in our system that are critical: individual choice and consumer direction, and we feel that this could be affected greatly. There have been no persuasive arguments made to advocates and consumers for the inclusion of managed health care and long-term care, and there's no evidence that it will increase the quality of care. There's no evidence that it will reach more clients, particularly important with the boomers exploding on the scene. There's no evidence that it's going to save any money. Actually, it probably will cost more. And finally, actually, on the contrary, it could cost a lot more. and not necessarily serve all the clients. The provider system could change in terms of which providers will be adequately used. And so it's just a concept that has great concern for us in a number of ways. So we're not saying they should all be wiped out, and we're certainly not saying there shouldn't be partnerships with managed health care and programs like the PACE Project and other projects that can go on. But when you're really going to incorporate it into our system and make some major changes and develop test projects, we just simply want the legislature to be able to discuss it and get a first look at it.
That, thank you, Jim. That's your bottom line, that the legislature should hear about it before any pilots are conducted?
Before any new policy is developed that incorporated into our system, before new pilot projects are developed, the new programs are developed, we just want it to come through the system because of how our advocates and consumers feel about this.
Okay.
We just want it to be debated within this process. That's all. It's a major change for our system.
Now, you mentioned an amendment that didn't show up properly. Is that...
Yes, that amendment should be here, and I don't know if some of my compatriots can answer that better than I, but we did put it in. We didn't, not through the committee assistant, you know, she's doing wonderful stuff for us, but it was through another legislator, and hopefully we can get that to you quickly, because this was not our intent, the way it's worded now.
Okay. In other words, we're not going to move this bill.
Well, we'd sure like you to.
Well, excuse me. If you have an amendment, and I'm kind of interested in hearing, you know, maybe Tina could come up and talk about the amendment, or if there's...
Well, they're not connected with this amendment.
Sorry. What I'm looking at is a point of agreement. You know, that's why I, you know, had James come up and said, you know, you're on the record, you're not going to do anything this biennium, right?
No.
But you're concerned that you want this bill as a safeguard against them doing any pilot projects or... So you... Okay.
Yes, Mr. Chair, we definitely would like that safeguard or some actual written guarantees that they have no intention of moving forward with this. But our concern is that in the future... They could start moving forward with this, and they want a process if that is being done.
James, could you come back, please? Is there a way short of legislation of dealing with this right now?
Mr. Chairman, I would just restate, I don't think legislation is necessary because, A, we wouldn't do anything, we wouldn't make substantial changes in our system without legislative approval anyway. I mean, anytime we develop new programs or change fund streams, that's always part of our budget process and the ways and means process where those discussions are pretty thoroughly vetted. Secondly, and I don't want to get into a rebuttal or a give and take here, but we're not proposing a major change in our system. The whole purpose of identifying something as a pilot from the beginning was it's small, it's controlled, you monitor it very, very closely to see what the results are, you do lots of research and planning around that. So this is not a hidden attempt to do this sort of massive conversion or privatization of our system. And finally, I'd say we have a model in Oregon that has lots of data. So to say there is no data, there is no examples of how this can be done well, I don't think is correct. But we're not in this to fight with our stakeholders. We cherish our stakeholders. The whole long-range planning process is a very iterative process. We've had lots of meetings, lots of work groups, public hearings all over the state. And we're concerned. I mean, we don't want to go forward with proposals that many of our stakeholders will oppose. At the same time, the issues facing long-term care are so profound, we have to look at all kinds of different approaches. And it is true, to make major changes in Oregon's long-term care system needs to be done very thoughtfully, very carefully, and not erode the kind of model and the choice that we've afforded seniors and people with disabilities in this state. But again, I think this legislation is projecting fears about things that certainly we don't think will happen, and So let me leave it at that.
Okay. Well, there are people that I admire greatly on both sides of this issue.
I understand.
And so we've run out of time today, but we are going to have that amendment drafted that you're talking about. And we will come back in a week or so. And we will hold a hearing, and we will see what happens in the meantime, and if we can deal with this other than a bill that says, just as you say, the legislative oversight before something, which you're saying is going to happen anyway, but let's...
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
How many meetings does this committee have?
Oh, as many as we want. I met with
before
the president
the 30th?
Today.
Before the 30th?
Just, you can go over the time limit if you want. How many meetings do we have?
4 minutes.
4 more meetings, and we will make room for this. It could be fairly quick, or, but no, because I see the concern, and I trust the agency, and I do, you know, respect both sides greatly, and I don't want to force something that isn't necessary. But we will come back again with the amendment. We'll have another hearing and see where things are.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 957, and we are going to carry over Senate Bill 14 into the next hearing on Wednesday, and the meeting is adjourned. So you're going to...